You're listening to the Builderpedia podcast, the only podcast that takes you on the whole property journey, from planning, design, building, selling, and everything in between. Along the way, we'll introduce you to our network of friends and colleagues who are experts in their field. Now, here are your hosts, Matt and Jeannie from Ballast Point.
Welcome back to another episode of Buildipedia. It's our first episode in the new year. How are you going, Matt?
Yeah, good, Jeannie. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. How has the start of your new year been?
Well, it's been hectic. I think we were supposed to have a slowdown and someone forgot to say something to our clients because we're busier than ever planning buildings, planning for submissions to council, planning for construction. So it's been insanely busy at our design office. We're bringing in some people to help.
And yeah, everything's happening all at once.
And Jeannie, it's nice to see that you haven't been deported yet. You're still in the country. Poor old Jeannie had a run in last year. Things didn't go to plan.
If anyone's dealing with immigration, make sure you submit your application as soon as possible because rules can change overnight and derail your plans.
Yeah,
it's fine. It's fine. I have a plan B, and everything's chugging along and working out fine.
We're going to keep Jeannie here. We're not letting her leave. And you can't leave Jeannie. Yeah, we've had a bit of a hiatus, I guess. We've been busy. Jeannie's been sorting out her visa. We've been having some time out and enjoying a break. And now we're back into it.
Back up and running. We have a few episodes from the end of last year that we're just in the process of editing and releasing. This episode is going to be the first one that we're recording in the new year. So stay tuned. The episode title for today is how to budget for your build. So it's going to be some key things to keep in mind in terms of when you first approach budgeting, especially in the new year. We're getting information in our office that there's going to be a lot of changes financially for people, where it's going to make the early steps of the design process in terms of budgeting more important than ever to keep in mind and to work with your design team, to work with your builder, to work with your subcontractors to make sure that everything goes to plan in the new year. But Matt will elaborate more on those details in the future.
Yeah. And so Jeannie, like, how is your property journey going? Like, surely I think it must have taken a bit of a hammering with, apart from trying to make sure that we keep you in Australia, you're also interest rates are going up, and I don't know where you are. So where were we last time we chatted? You know, you were still in the property curious phase.
Definitely. Yeah, definitely property curious. But I think at this stage, it's more about the fact that I think most people in this boat, I'm in my early 20s, I'm trying to work out life and adulting and keep things stable. So yeah, like one thing at a time, but it's always good to just learn about what other people are doing in their lives and how to get there.
And has the market and the interest rates like added your confidence a little bit, or have you not even had time to think about that?
Honestly, if I'm going to get really honest, in my life, I think towards the end of last year and probably for the next few years in the future, I think the focus is probably more about career and where my skills are best used and what direction that I want to go down. So I think that's more taking up my brain space as well as like staying, you know, like financially stable and all that kind of stuff. So I think it's just a process in terms of saving and, you know, all the stuff that everyone knows that goes into the property journey. But I just wouldn't say that that's at the forefront of my mind
Oh yeah, well, you know, you've got time up your sleeve, and I think one of the things that people always say is, you know, it's less affordable than it used to be, but it was always hard. It's always going to be hard. Like, you just have to make it happen at some point. I think
the concept of rent vesting has definitely been interesting, and I think it appeals to a lot of people in my particular circumstance. Or in my age cohort. Have you heard of that?
Rent vesting? I may have heard of it, but I don't know what it is right now. now that you've mentioned it, what's rent vesting?
So from my understanding, rent vesting is where you rent where you want to live but can't afford to buy. And you buy basically an investment property, something that you rent out to other people to kind of like generate an income. And it's the best when it's positively geared, when all of the income you gain from that investment covers all of your expenses so that it just kind of like pays for itself. That's the best case scenario. And you kind of just do that to get on the property ladder without like the traditional route of buying a home and like owning it and living in it. But you're still getting into the property market. I think in a nutshell, that's my understanding of rent vesting. And again, like the reason why it's so appealing to, I think, people my age is probably because it sounds more achievable whilst the compromises aren't as much.
Yeah, yeah. No, that makes sense. But I guess the downside of that is that you're investing in property somewhere else that maybe you don't know as much about the best place, I've always said this, everyone knows this, everyone knows this of me, that my philosophy is invest where you live, where you know really well, invest where you know the market, you know the streets. But also, if you're living in Sydney, then you're investing elsewhere. Potentially, there's the prices in Sydney will always, the growth in Sydney on balance of probability will outpace growth elsewhere. So I think, yeah. Absolutely. I mean, but it's still worthwhile, but I don't think it's as good as trying to get the tiniest toehold in where you actually are and where you want to live. That's the ultimate. So, but yeah, it's tough. It's tough out there. I don't think it's the worst time to buy, because when everyone else is thinking of buying is probably not the best time, but you know, people are sort of, properties are still turning over, but a lot of people have kind of got bigger problems. They're worried about their job, they're worried about interest rates. At some point, interest rates are going to drop and prices are going to accelerate because they've gone backwards. So yeah, if you can swing it, now's the time to actually, you know, it's counterintuitive because interest rates are going up, you have to allow for extra payments, it's harder to borrow probably, but you know, it's when it's the worst time that it is probably the best time, so to speak. I don't know if that makes sense. But I know it's a good time because clients and friends and people aren't ringing me. I know it's a bad time to buy when everyone's ringing me going, oh, I've got this property I want to invest in, can you look at it for me? But like past clients, potential clients, like when people are looking to invest, you know, it's not a good time, but they all ring me at the same time. It's funny how that comes in cycles. You haven't heard from them for a year and then suddenly the market's hotting up and they're all starting to ring again, and I'm like, why didn't you ring me a year ago when I was anyway? I think we've gone off the rails. The conversation's gone off the rails, but let's bring it back with someone who's inspired you, Jeannie. Have you got somebody in mind?
I go first.
Yeah, or do you want me to go first?
Yeah, go first.
So I have got an interesting one. I am loving open AI. I'm all over it. I think it's, I think the amazing thing isn't what it's doing for me right now. I think it's the potential. So at the moment, I'm like, you know, if I can relate it back to a toolkit, right now I'm doing everything with a hammer with ChatGPT. It's like I've got a hammer, I'm just hammering at everything. But potentially, when those tools are refined, it's a phenomenal leap. I think I'm really enjoying it. It's lifted my productivity incredibly in terms of writing, putting blog posts together. Like it's been a phenomenal boost. And not in the way most people think. It's not doing work for me, but it's giving me a starting point. It's giving me a counterpoint. It's helping speed up research. It helps you generate ideas. And so anyway, I'll stop talking now. I'll let you talk. But Sam Altman, I mean, what a phenomenon. I mean, he started Y Combinator and now he's the CEO of the most talked about disruptive technology. And he's just unleashed it, you know, in an incredibly ballsy way. He's just unleashed it on the world. And no one knows whether we're ready for it. So, Jeannie, who's your inspiration?
For me, I think someone who's come into my orbit recently is probably James Cameron. I've been rewatching a lot of his films to do with Avatar, to do with Titanic. But I think I've also started watching a lot of interviews to do with like who he is as a person. And I think that's been really interesting to learn. But in a nutshell, I think what I gained from all those interviews is that I guess there's like a lot of rumors that he's not a particularly easy person to work with, but I think through the interviews and understanding how he thinks and why he is the way that he is, it helped me understand in his particular industry, in order to push forward like this massive idea and make it a reality and have so many people involved and kind of like to make everything work exactly the way he envisioned it. It kind of like requires him to be a certain way, but the outcome is that it's extremely effective. And at least for me, I really enjoy his films.
Yeah, and you're the biggest Avatar fan I know. You've seen, tell us how many times you've seen the new one.
Yeah, I'm sure I'm not the only person who thinks that. But I think, yeah, just in general, it's been interesting just to learn about different people who have created things that have an impact on my life and how they think about things and how they make things work. And I think another thing that I learned from him is that he was basically a truck driver for the longest time until he basically gave himself a college education on filmmaking without going to college. He just kind of went into the library and taught himself everything. And his thing is like, when you pursue something, you kind of have to jump in full time. And that's how he kind of I don't know how he made it work at the beginning, but he did. But he was just saying, in order to achieve something extraordinary, it does take all of your time.
Yeah.
Like, just kind of be like jumping in and out of things. Like, so I don't know. It's something that makes you think a lot about kind of like the risks and rewards in a lot of things.
Yeah. And what is it? Tell us what it is about Avatar that you've seen it. I think you've seen the old one like 100 times and you've seen the new one multiple times. What is it about Avatar that really inspires you?
I love that it's a completely different world it's almost like an idealistic world. In my view, it's not everyone's ideal, sure. But I like the fantasy part of it and how it's kind of like a world that's like untouched and everything's natural and it's kind of like the way that it's supposed to be. I like that kind of idea to it. I don't know. I don't really talk about this a lot, so I don't know whether it makes me sound incredibly naive or...
No. Should we extrapolate that you're a fan of Meta then? Because, you know, there's some parallels between Avatar and the metaverse, right? Or not?
No. The metaverse.
Let's leave it there. Maybe we should move on. Otherwise, we're going to be. I'm worried. I've just opened a can of worms, and maybe we should talk about that another time.
Okay, so let's get into the questions for Matt today to do with budgeting. First one is, why is it important to create a realistic budget for a home build project?
So I think the most important thing with a budget is that if you are on a budget and the project is going to fail without sticking to a budget, then it's very important that you make that a key project objective and you repeat that a few times if builder or your architect is not listening. But I think I've really muddled that up. I don't know. I'm really stuck. Sorry.
So I guess to tease that question out further, a realistic budget, how does a client go about ascertaining what even is a realistic budget for someone who has never done this before, have no idea in general how things cost and might have a really skewed, you know, conception of what things cost, and it might be misaligned to what people more experienced and in the industry knows to be the actual cost?
Yeah, so the first thing I would say to get a realistic budget happening, or to get a realistic budget, I think you need to maybe talk to a few people and not just rely on one piece of advice or just presume that someone's going to deliver. I think you can do that by just fundamentally talking to different people and showing them their plans and getting an opinion. If the opinions are pretty close together, then you might be close to the money. But if you're getting a wild variance, then yeah, maybe go with an average. Don't, you know, people have a tendency to focus on the number that most appeals to them, and sometimes that'll be the lowest number. So yeah, the thing to do is to get advice, but then maybe ask for context to that advice. Like, what do you base that on? What is, like, actually interrogate a little bit and go, well, what did the last building that was similar cost, and when did you build that? And maybe talk to other people, if you can, who have built something similar, and say, hey, where did you end up with the final number? Rather than being promised something that may or may not be based on any science in terms of science of costing or estimating. So you can have mistakes. It's not hard. Like, the thing about budgets is it's really easy to see what has been doubled up. It's so hard to find what's missing. and we've had this recently where we're unable to be explained rationally, but our competent, experienced professional estimator missed a vital component. They do miss things, but yeah, do a little bit of due diligence rather than just accepting what the first person says is my suggestion. Talk to other clients. See what's actually happening rather than what someone says might be able to happen, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. And I guess a question that I had from your answer a bit earlier is about, if your builder or if your architect is not listening as a client, is the onus on the client to keep the budget at the forefront throughout this process of budgeting? Or, like, how should a client keep the budget on top of mind if it isn't already so, with the people that they have enlisted to help them?
Yeah, so I guess that's a really great question, because even in our architecture practice, like, we have to work hard to make sure that that budget is front center. If that's a key objective for a specific client, to bring it in to a specific budget, because sometimes that might be all they have to spend, which is totally fine. We have to work to have it front of mind. So I think it depends on who you're working with, but it doesn't hurt to just go, hey, just reiterating that one of our objectives is to keep it under this budget. It doesn't hurt to remind people. And I think we're probably better than most keeping the budget in focus. But even in our practice, we, you know, admittedly, we do miss things or skip things or find that we've been on a journey and ended up somewhere that's outside of the budget. I mean, because it's an uncertain journey, and there's 1,000 decisions that get made during that journey that, you know, that can compound and push you one way or another.
Because I know, as part of our business process with our clients, that we like, especially throughout, like, the design and the concept phase, there are regular check-ins between the team and the client. So would you say for the client, usually it's part of those weekly check-ins that you kind of, aside from talking about the fun stuff, like what fixtures, what the design's going to look like, you can also pull out kind of like the numbers and the spreadsheet, kind of work to that. Would you say?
Like, yeah, where are we up to? And one thing that I drill into all the guys in our office is, don't select something without knowing the price. So we drill down to make sure that we, like, if I review a fitting schedule and there's no prices on it, I send it back and say, give me context, because we need, like, it's just good practice. And when you are selecting fittings, the prices are there. Just add them to the schedule so that we all know what the likely price will be or what the likely budget should be. So yeah, but it's not easy, because we all want to create great things, and we all want it to cost less for our clients. Like, so it's not, there's no sneaky, you know, there's no kind of agenda. Well, maybe some architects I work with, they may be a bit sneaky in that sense, but or they might just bury it, put their head in the sand and pretend that they didn't know. But there's not, most people just want it to cost less, and most builders and architects and consultants, we all want it to cost less for our clients. What I'm trying to say is we struggle to have an objective view of where it's heading. So we need to put mechanisms in place like, okay, for example, on our drawings on the front cover, if the budget is an objective, is one of the key objectives. And even if it isn't, we put the budget on there anyway, if there's a working budget. Occasionally you get clients who just say, hey, let's design it and then see what the price is and then we'll work it out. And that's fine if the client is happy to do that. But most of the time, 90% or more of our clients will have a budget in mind or have a finite resource to spend on a build.
Yeah. Okay, so moving on to the next question, what factors should homeowners consider when estimating the cost of a home build, including contingencies?
So I think the most common mistake is taking a budget from the wrong kind of building or from the wrong analog, so to speak. So I mentioned the fact before that if you're building, if your architect's an experimental avant-garde amazing architect who builds prototype buildings and really advances architecture, you need the appropriate budget for that. So if you're hiring Peter Stutchbury to design your house, the budget needs to be appropriate. If you take a budget from a project home and apply it to that build, you're going to be very disappointed. And also the thing that we found is that we operate in the inner west, most primarily inner west and east, and we've had empty nesters moving back and selling their house in the suburbs and attempting to move back, and they can't believe how much things cost in the inner west because they had a whole house built for X amount. But there are differences. For a start, access. And everything, you know, if you can drive onto your site and with a concrete pump, with material, with whatever, that makes the job so much more cost effective. If you're having to carry everything by hand because you've got street access and then you've got three levels or two levels below street and the only access is the front door and you're landlocked, that's going to change the price completely. The other thing is every building in the inner west is built specifically for its site, and so it's a very much a custom solution. So if you adopt project home rates from areas where you can adopt a pre-designed home from a project home builder and build that on your site, the economics of that are very different to a bespoke design from scratch to fit a narrow site. So I think the budget has to factor that in. So there's no point kind of going, well, the last house we built was $4,000 a square meter. So, and that was to a reasonable standard, but it was in the western suburbs of Sydney on a bigger block. And so let's build something for $4,000 a square meter in Balmain or Rozelle. It won't work. Like those, it's a different set of economics.
Because this is an episode about budget, just to give our listeners a crystal clear kind of idea of what numbers we're talking about, and out of my own interest as well, what would a home project cost with an architect like Peter Stutchbury versus your standard project home project? Like, what numbers are we looking at and what is the difference?
Again, it depends on the site and how big the house is, because what you've got to understand is that parts of the house cost a lot more than other parts. So a bathroom costs a lot more than a living room, typically, depending on, of course, the standard of the joinery and other things. But per square meter, wet areas, kitchens are the most expensive part of the house. And I guess there's a unit price as well. So a unit price per bathroom, with the bathrooms twice as big or half the size, probably still only going to have one toilet. It's marginally different in terms of the amount of plumbing work involved. Yeah, there's longer runs of pipe, but there's one toilet to fit off, one or two shower heads, you know, one water service, like, yeah, more material in PVC and plastic pipe, but about the same amount of work in terms of labor. So it depends is the answer. But the biggest misconception about per square meter rates for estimating a construction budget is that you can just apply it to a little bit here and a little bit there. Those rates are designed to apply to the whole property, even the bits that you're not renovating, and they need to be adjusted for maybe if you're only renovating a part of the house, you need to adjust those rates, but take into account the whole house. And that might sound more counterintuitive or like unworkable, but the point is that if you're leaving the front of the house intact, typically a couple of bedrooms, and you're adding a couple of bedrooms to the back, you're typically redoing the power and the water and the sewer and probably redoing all of the bathrooms. And you're still going to repaint those two rooms that you're going to leave intact, and you're still probably going to put another light fitting. So the cost of leaving those two bedrooms as opposed to building them from scratch is not huge. And so you have to, and because the rate per square meter of a wet area is so much more, or is a larger part of the equation, you really have to measure the whole house and then allow a rate that allows for maybe part of the house being existing, part of the house not being existing, you know, but the rate is applied to the whole house. So what people get wrong is they go, oh, someone told me that you can build for $8,000 a square meter, which is about a, you know, sort of was a premium rate. Now it's probably more like a standard rate. But, you know, so I'm just putting a kitchen and living zone and a couple of bathrooms on the back of the house. So and that's 50 square meters. So I should just multiply the rate by the number of square meters. And you're like, well, it doesn't quite work like that. That's not how the rate was intended to be used. So I guess really get advice is the key. Get lots of advice. If you get a rate, understand how to apply it, because normally a square meter rate needs to be applied to the whole property, not just the little bit you think you're building.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't work.
So I guess that leads quite nicely into our next question, which is about how to save money during the home build process without sacrificing quality or safety. So in terms of so we've talked about the square meter rates, but you were also saying earlier that there are some parts of the house which isn't as important.
I guess, well, I'll say one more thing about budgeting is, like, it's been a crazy time for budgets and for projects that maybe started a year ago in planning in terms of, you know, the initial design process or even before that. You know, we had a 20% contingency on those, and that's a reasonable contingency. And we're finding that price escalation alone is more than 20%. So the contingency's blown before we've even started, unfortunately, and that's been a big problem. But equally, we don't know where the contingency, where the price escalation is going, because we thought maybe things might slow down, but prices are still going up. So it's, you know, we're kind of thinking, well, at some point, like, what should the contingency be? It should be more like probably 30 or more percent at the moment, because of the more uncertainty in the market, the higher the contingency should be. But back to your point on where to save, I think, I mean, like, this is my opinion, I guess, but save on the finishers, spend more on the craftsmen and the quality. Mm. And, you know, the thing that you'll find when you're budgeting is there's some ridiculous variability in even the base build. And I'll tell you a short story of where, you know, how that variability plays out. And I mean, I remember a long time ago tendering against another builder, and their price was a lot less. And the client understandably went with that builder, but then they finished the build and the client rang me and said, can you come and do a few things? We want to install a door and we want to do this and do that. And I sort of said politely, but wouldn't you get the builder that built the house to do that? And they sort of said, well, we don't really speak to them anymore. But the thing that was interesting is when I went to the house, I sort of thought, hey, this is this doesn't look bad. Like, this looks good. I mean, they're a lot more cost effective, but the house actually looked good. It was only when one of my carpenters started trying to install a new door in an existing corridor, and he rang me and he said, oh, I've got a bit of a problem here because the wall's out of plumb. And I'm like, well, we'll just adjust. And, you know, it's like, and he said, no, it's a lot out of plumb. Like it's, and I'm like, well, we'll just adjust it this way and then we'll tweak the door and that should be all right. And he's like, no, it's out of square as well by a long way. So it wasn't perceptible to the eye, but this house was all over the place. And then I got a call from that client to say, hey, I know it's not your problem, but there's a problem with our sewer. It's blocked up. There's something wrong. And I sent our plumber out and I got a phone call to say, oh, I think there's a bit of a problem here. Next thing I know, we've had to dig up their whole front yard because the sewer hadn't been connected. And so you get this incredible variability in quality of simple things, let alone materials, let alone finishes.
So is it, in a nutshell, are you saying it's a situation of you get what you pay for?
Oh, it can be. But yeah, I think you do get what you pay for. If someone is, on balance of probability, you get what you pay for. I mean, I'm sure there's poor clients that have paid a premium and still got a terrible outcome. But I think, you know, there are ways around that. You know, clients can do due diligence about but you can't get away from the fact that there's great variability and great variability in price as well. And I don't know where I was going with that. but
it just sounds like a bit of a minefield from a client standpoint.
Look, I think that there's some rules of thumb, right? The rules of thumb are get a few opinions. Don't rely on the one person. Then the second thing is ask how they arrived and what the outcomes were and how they got to the price that they're telling you and how much other things have cost rather than how much they want it to cost for you. And, you know, get some feedback and do some due diligence and say, hey, can I speak to some of your other clients? If you're hiring a new architect, talk to a few of their clients and say, hey, how did you go by the time you finished the build? How did you go with budget? You know, and like I said, clients, we all want it to cost less. We can't be relied upon as an industry. I can just be brutally honest and say we can't be relied upon for price. We get experts, we get estimators to help us with an objective pricing. But there is uncertainty in pricing and you've got to allow a good contingency and not eat that contingency up with design changes. But I think equally, I mean, my advice to clients is if you are budget conscious, then make that the underlying objective and make sure that you keep that in focus and you make good decisions through the outset. We've had instances where we've tried to push back on price, but we're conflicted because we want what the clients want. We want to achieve all their objectives. And sometimes you can't. Sometimes if you're focused on price, you can deliver to that price, but you've got to compromise. You can't have everything that's on your wish list. Mm-hmm. So
is that on us though, as the professionals, to be really strict about?
Yeah, but it's really hard. Like it's really hard because you sometimes you're trying to, you have to be the Scrooge in the room and, you know, shit can their dreams, and you don't, sometimes you actually have that role and, you know, like we've found sometimes clients will ignore that because they want something.
Yeah.
And you're kind of going, well, you're almost, I mean, I had a great, one of our former clients had built in Holland and they had a Dutch architect who every time they suggested something just turned around and just said in a very deadpan voice, you can't afford it. And I kind of, No one wants to be that guy.
Yeah.
Who says, you can't afford it. But and sometimes I am that guy, but I don't say it like that. Try and be more diplomatic. But it's an awful job. No one wants to do it. No one wants to be that person who says, you can't afford it.
Yeah. But I also guess that's the purpose of these episodes, is so that, you know, if a potential client is listening in, they get the bigger picture. And so when you get to that conversation, they kind of have more context about why they need to compromise, and they're not just hearing, oh, they don't want to do what we want to do.
Yeah, I look up, but it's still like, yeah, we know all this, but it's still tough to implement. Like, there's no denying it from a builder, from a design team. We want a good outcome all around, but and it's hard. Like,
it's
not like, and that's the thing, you know, a lot of people complain about architects, and I used to complain about architects, and you know, but it's a very tough position, because you want to deliver the very best for your clients, and yeah, there's no denying that at times
there's like a financial reality.
There's a financial reality, and sometimes it's easier to put your head in the sand and pretend that somehow you're gonna get someone to do it for less. And I think that's really clutching at straws. And that's if you're holding out for the hope that you're gonna find someone who can do it for less, you're gonna potentially find out why they can do it for less, and you're not going to be happy with the outcome, maybe.
Yeah, that's quite blunt, but yeah.
We're lost for words, Jeannie. We're done.
Yeah, reality. Okay, so the next question is, what are some common mistakes homeowners make when budgeting for a build, and how can they avoid these mistakes? So I guess that goes hand in hand with what we were talking about, to prevent those mistakes in the first place. There are some things you can do in terms of looking for, like, doing your due diligence, looking for multiple reviews, checking against multiple professionals. Is that right?
Yeah, the number one mistake is not having enough budget for what you want to build in the first place, and not enough contingency. So that's the mistake. And even when we've had enough, we thought we had enough contingency until mid post COVID, and whatever contingency we thought was enough ended up not being enough.
Yeah. So just to make this information current, that contingency should be 30% at the time that we're speaking now.
Ah, look, you tell me what it should be. I don't know. Like, our leading economists know what it should be. But I think one more piece of advice I would give is, have levers to pull on your project. And if I can explain that, create a design by which you can leave things out of the build. You can not execute some of it and leave the intent of the design intact. And because what happens is that people create a design that really falls apart once you leave an element out of it. So factor that into your design, where you might say, okay, if we get to a point where we've got enough budget to do the whole thing, let's do the whole thing, but let's design it in a way where things can be left out, like the front of the house doesn't need to be redesigned, or it can be staged, or we can leave a part of it, or we can leave something out, or we can do something differently and it'll still work. Because the problem that you have is, if you've designed it in such a way where it's all or nothing, where if you leave a component out, the whole design doesn't work, then you really the levers you can pull are on quality of build and quality of material. Yeah, I think that's where you're stuck, because you start pulling things out, the design can unravel.
Yeah, so it's almost like in terms of like the quality of the build, that should almost be a contingency in itself in the budget, so that you're not maxing yourself out in terms of all the parts of the design that's part of the program. Like, you can remove some while still having enough to afford like a good quality tradesman and have things go smoothly to get you the result that you want.
Yeah, absolutely. And give yourself a lever you can pull is maybe having a pool that you've intended to build. But okay, if you are on a tight budget, any pool's going to be more than 100 grand. That's a custom pool, so that's a lever you can pull, and you can leave that pool till later or leave it out. That's probably the simplest example. Or leave the garage out, or leave build the main building.
Yeah, the important
part. And not integrate a garage into it. Design the garage as a separate standalone thing that can be done later or not done, and still have a great functioning home. I'll tell you one more thing. Like, one of the biggest mistakes, one of the catastrophic mistakes that people make, and I've seen this, and this is the grand, typical of grand designs. People who are on a budget think that some experimental new building technique is going to cut their budget, is a way to save money.
What's an example of that?
And I've, an example is precast concrete, using precast concrete, because precast panels are, on paper, they're cheaper per square meter than off-form concrete or concrete that's poured in situ. But the amount of work that goes into designing that panel and everything that goes around it is a lot more expensive. So no, there's a reason why we don't build houses out of precast concrete.
Yeah, yeah.
And you're very unlikely to adopt some new technology that no one else is using and save money. You'll find why, you know, 99.9% of the time, you'll find out why that doesn't work, and you'll find out the hard way when your budget's already under strain. So my hot tip, or if you're on a budget, stick to very standard building practices. Go with the generic building. Don't start cost cutting with experiments, because they don't work. It doesn't work, you know. And the other thing is, if you're building using a technique that is uncommon, there's a good chance that the person that you need to help you isn't going to be around as readily as other trades. So on a budget, use good tradesmen, use good quality tradesmen, but budget material. That's my insight, because as we know, the most cost effective tile laid really well is 100 times better than the most expensive tile badly laid. So, you know, if you're on a budget, go with quality trades that make, and we've seen this so many times, that the most simplest cost effective tile, beautifully laid, looks amazing. The most expensive piece of stone badly laid looks terrible from day one. But
so it sounds like it's a matter of prioritizing, and for a client you definitely need professionals to help you work out what to prioritize and what should make it up the top end of your budget. So with that in mind, which professionals, Matt, would you say that a client needs to keep in mind when they're starting this process of building and putting together their budget? And how does it differ from at the very beginning, before you even have a set of plans together, versus later on, once you have a working design and you have a general scope of the works that you want to achieve?
That's a very long question. I'm a simple guy. You need to ask simple, short questions.
So which are the professionals the client needs to enlist to help them put together the budgets?
Okay, so initially get advice from local builders, and like I said, a good resource is other people who have built in the area or built similar things. That's your best resource from the outset. And then once you're actually progressing through the design, I couldn't stress how invaluable this is. Pay for a professional estimator to measure and get subcontract quotes. And you can actually see what's behind the budget. You can see how it's formulated. Pay for that, and then give that, or pay your builder to make that available to you. Pay a professional estimator, or otherwise known as a quantity surveyor, to create a budget that you can then see inside. Rather than, you know, there is great variability in construction pricing, and some builders, when they're busy, they just up their price and do some sums on the back of an envelope, you know, over a beer. The best way you can get some science into the budget is by understanding the quantities and the rates and the subcontracts that go into it. So the more you can have an open conversation and share information with your builder, the better will be the budget, the quality of the budget, I guess.
Well, thanks, Matt, for your time today and helping our listeners learn more about how to budget for their home project. In summary, can you please summarize for us the three main points from today's episode that you want our listeners to take away with them?
The three things when creating a budget that I reckon are the most important is, one, make sure you've got the right budget for the right sort of build, the right sort of development. So if it's an experimental architectural masterpiece, don't use your project home budget for it. The second thing is the right advice from the right people. Talk to builders, architects, talk to prospective or talk to their previous clients and ask them what their experience was and where the budget ended up. And number three is understand the budget, interrogate the budget, like get and understand how the builders come up with that budget and ask questions. If you're looking at a square meter rate, understand how that works and that you're applying it correctly before you budget. They're the three things that are going to make all the difference, I think.
Mm-hmm. So for me, it sounds like for a client, when you're first approaching a home build, it's a really energy intensive process and it's a necessary investment at the very beginning of your project to work out the budget and talk to the right people, the right professionals to help you work out and prioritize what should make it up towards the top of your list and what maybe you think is important at the time, but it actually might not be later on down the line to get to a successful
outcome. Absolutely. And you should, like, it's one of the key reasons for project failure. Like, projects fail to get off the ground because the budgeting was wrong. And that, so it can't be overstated enough. It's very important to get that budget right from the outset.
And another important thing for me, at the beginning of this conversation, we were also talking about how to implement a successful strategy to keep the budget top of mind throughout the whole construction and design phase. And I think one of our tips is to, at your weekly catch-ups or bi-weekly catch-ups with your design team, it's good to have all of the fun design elements in mind, but also to have a working spreadsheet that is also a meeting item to keep track of all the expenses and just to keep everyone on the same page in terms of the number of the project.
Absolutely. So to keep reminding your builder, your architect, your team that you are on a budget and that's the finite budget. Keep reiterating that. It's normal for people to be focused on creating brilliant things and forgetting where it started and what the key parameters are, what the key objectives are. People forget. So it doesn't hurt to keep reminding the team, hey, you realize we're on a budget. You've just designed this amazing thing. How much is it going to cost? And how do you know how much it's going to cost? And should we ask someone how much it's going to cost? Should we get a professional estimator to tell us how much that amazing, I don't know, beehive creation or whatever is going to cost? Because I might not be able to afford it by the time you've finished designing it.
Thank you so much for sharing that. We'll talk next time. Bye.
Thank you, Jeannie. Look forward to catching up again soon.
Thank you for tuning into Buildopedia. If you enjoyed this episode, please give us a rating to help other listeners like you find our podcast. For more information, please check out the show notes and connect with us on social media. We would love to hear from you.